Awesome. So this will be fun. Yeah. Well, in all seriousness, thanks for joining us this afternoon. My name is Jay Schmelzer. I'm one of the directors of program management for Visual Studio and .NET at Microsoft. I've spent about a little over the last 13 years of my life working at Microsoft. All of it has been in the developer tools group. Pretty much covered the full spectrum of everything that we do in the what I'll call the core construction space. So runtimes, frameworks, programming languages, core IDE kinds of experiences. But the only part of the product I haven't directly worked in is the team system kind of things, the ALM tools. So everything else as far as actually getting the apps constructed and deployed is stuff that I've been working on over the last 13 years. Prior to that, spent about 10 years with a couple small mid-sized consulting firms based in the Chicago area doing custom software development. So I kind of went from creating custom applications, working with large enterprises and organizations, to creating the tools and runtimes and frameworks to create those applications. The last few years of my Microsoft career have been with the .NET team. So kind of took over that role right as we were starting to think about what's next for .NET. And so all of the open sourcing and cross-platform and all that kind of stuff is kind of where I was from the beginning. So what we're going to do today is talk a little bit about, I'll set the stage a little bit. I won't spend a ton of time on it, but I just want to make sure that we have a good set of context as to why we're doing this, what it looks like. A few things have changed in the last month with some recent announcements we've made. So I just want to kind of give you a frame for how we think about that, where we're going with it. And then dive into some of the specifics of what that looks like, scenarios we're thinking about. I'm actually going to invite one of our kind of customers slash partners on stage to show a little bit of how they're taking advantage of .NET Core in an interesting way to build their products as well. So we got a nice sized group, but what we'll try to do is I'll try to leave time at the end for questions. If you absolutely have a burning question or completely confused, throw up your hand, shout it out. Just please don't throw anything at me. Unless you really want to end the session early, then go ahead and throw something and we can all go outside and I'll go to the hospital or whatever I have to do. So with that, let's dive in. I use this slide a lot, but I think it's important to really set the frame for how things are being thought about inside of the developer division at Microsoft, but also just Microsoft as a whole. And these are really the three primary themes that drive the way we focus our efforts right now. And I'll walk through them kind of quickly. The first one is often a little bit misunderstood, the idea of innovation. Typically, as Microsoft, we get really, really good at talking about what we're currently working on. We probably suffer a little bit from that shiny object syndrome. And so we want to talk about all the new things we're doing and all that kind of stuff. And we don't spend as much time talking about the investments in innovation we're making in the technologies that you're probably building with today is probably the best way to put it. When we think about innovation, we think about it in both aspects. So as it relates to .NET specifically, what that means is the .NET framework, which is the phrase I use to describe the version of .NET that was designed for Windows, deploys with Windows, is a pretty comprehensive set of libraries and capabilities that we've been working on for the last 15 years or so. You've probably been building software on it for that same amount of time. We continue to invest and focus our energy in ensuring that we're creating the right technology for you and your applications to continue evolving, continue to meet the needs of your business, the stuff that you've built over the last few years. We balance that with the need to go and ensure we're also creating the technologies you need to build the next wave of applications you're being asked to develop, things that you're being asked to build tomorrow for the next 5-10 years. We'll talk a little bit about what some of those characteristics are, but reality was that they were fundamental enough that they required us to really reimagine .NET and the runtime to meet the needs of those application models as well as the application styles that you're using. For example, 15 years ago, continuous integration, continuous delivery, DevOps, those were not things we were talking about as software developers very often. Microservices was not a pattern that we were talking about. So as those things have evolved and we've gotten to really better understand them and really practice them, we realize that they have demands on the runtimes and frameworks. You want small, modular, componentized architectures. You want a deployment model that gives you confidence that the version of the runtime and libraries and so forth you used in development and you push to testing and you push production is going to stay consistent regardless of whether other applications come onto those machines or other dependencies people bring in. And so we needed to really rethink the way we architected .NET to support that. I'll jump to the third pillar there, which also influences this, which is the notion of expanding our view of applications beyond the ecosystem that is Windows. Historically, if I say .NET, one of the first words that's gonna come to your mind is Windows. If it wasn't Windows, it's probably Visual Studio, right? And those are great, we love those, we continue to invest in those, but reality is, over the last several years, the applications you're being asked to develop aren't just targeting Windows. We aren't all just carrying Windows devices. This is actually one of the least glowing fruit rooms I've been in for a while, but typically when I get up in front of a bunch of developers, I see a lot of logos that are glowing at me that aren't Windows logos. As developers, we're starting to use those machines. We're using those machines because we're being asked to develop software that targets those platforms, targets an iPhone, targets Android. In the server space, we know that there's a lot of initiatives going on across various enterprises to start doing some consolidation of server operating systems. There's new technologies coming out to support new application patterns in the large-scale service world, like microservices and stuff like that, with Docker, that are appearing first in a Linux environment, and you're being asked to target those. We don't want you to have to move away from everything you've been doing, move away from the programming languages and the core concepts that you understand to be able to target those environments and meet those needs. This whole thing is all about growing the developer ecosystem of folks that just interact with and engage with us as Microsoft. We want to be a tool provider and a technology provider for every developer out there targeting any application on any platform. That's really what we're all about. And that's the biggest fundamental shift that's happened for us over the last couple of years, also driving some of these changes. The third real focus inside the developer tools group, as well as across all of Microsoft, is this notion of the way we work, modernizing our own development practices. And for us, that typically gets hung under the tag of openness. Openness, of course, is about open source, but that's just the beginning of it. Yes, the code being available outside the corporate firewall, allowing and engaging with developers that aren't just Microsoft employees on the design and development of that and code contributions is important, but it's more fundamentally about just shifting the culture inside of our development teams and the way we work and being a modern, open, collaborative, transparent software development organization. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it today, but I will say that has been the biggest fundamental change I've seen over the last couple years inside of the teams I work with. You see different stages of maturity across those teams. Some teams have been doing it for a little bit longer. They've learned a lot of lessons. They've got pretty good practices down. Other teams are just getting started. And in some cases this morning, someone was mentioning that one of the teams, seems to be only one person that interacts with the broad ecosystem. Was that by design? No, it's exactly the opposite of what we want. It just so happens that there's a lot of folks on that team that aren't quite comfortable talking to you yet. I don't know why, you guys are always nice to me when I talk to you, so I don't know what they're thinking. But, so it's learning that, thinking about it, right? Adjusting the roles of the engineers on the team to, when I started at Microsoft, that first year was really the first time we created the ability for our customers to submit bug reports to us. And we'd have these bugs flow right into the normal bug database. It was baffling to me that I would come in some mornings and I would have 150 bugs assigned to me that were all bugs, and I was a program manager. I didn't write the code, right? So I had bugs assigned to me to close because the team decided we weren't gonna fix it, but it was opened by a customer, so I had to go write the response to the customers to why we weren't fixing the bug. Needless to say, that didn't happen very often. I typically went back to the engineer, do I need to get you a new keyboard? Because clearly, it just did not work. So just teaching and getting people more familiar with it. The, that's part of it. The bigger part for us is really just the transparent, the ultimate transparency of what we're doing. And it's not there across the teams. If you look at .NET Core, those of you who have been following it, you see a great example there where we published timelines for the project. All of a sudden, one morning, you may have looked at the timeline page and noticed that it got updated, and suddenly there were no dates for the last two milestones of the product. Not a huge explanation of why, just they weren't there anymore. Team thought they were doing the right thing, realized that, hey, the product's not gonna be ready, those dates aren't valid, let's stop letting people think they are. But replacing them with no date at all, probably not the best thing for us to have done. Also dialing that back and realizing that, wow, it shouldn't have actually been a surprise to the community that those dates weren't gonna stick, right? We should have all known earlier on and been much more transparent that, hey, this is not landing the way we thought it was, it's gonna take a little bit longer. The other aspect of that you see with .NET Core is this seeming moving of direction sometimes, like mainly around things like, you know, NuGet and, you know, the TFMs and those kinds of things. We changed those a few times, how that was gonna work. I'll talk a little bit about how we're gonna change it again. A lot of folks have said, what the heck's going on? Who's driving this ship? Do you guys not know what you're doing? Well, it turns out that's always the way it's worked inside the team. You just didn't get to see it before. Because we would go spend 2 years trying different approaches, exploring different things, all privately, and then kind of come out with a, hey, ta-da, look at this, isn't it awesome moment, and then ask you for feedback, which typically got sent back to the PMs to say, sorry, thanks for the suggestion, but not now, we're shutting down, right? So all of that, moving it forward, moving it more open, is what we talk about, and I've spent way more time on that than I should have, but I wanted to give you the context of where we're at, and actually, it's an encouragement, too, to engage, right? Like, if something doesn't look right, engage, ask about it, because it probably doesn't look right, and we just haven't, you know, realized that we need to share that more. So let's talk a little bit about what this kind of means for .NET as the final part of the frame, and then we'll get into the kind of more fun stuff. Well, so one of the things that happened, and hopefully you can see that, and I apologize that we're gonna get color crazy here for a bit. One way to think about this today is that today the family of .NET, what is .NET, has gotten bigger. We used to have the .NET framework, which was the pretty much if you said you were doing .NET development, that was 98% of what you were doing was, you were most likely doing work in the .NET framework, which was the framework designed for and shipped with Windows. It's a Windows component, it ships as a Windows component, it will continue to ship and version as a Windows component. A little over a month ago, we announced our intent, and a few weeks ago, we completed the acquisition of Xamarin. What that did was introduced a new member of the .NET family. We now had Mono coming into kind of the I don't know, stewardship of Microsoft. So if you hadn't heard, a few weeks ago we announced that we were, you know, taking Mono into the .NET Foundation. We were changing the license on Mono to be an MIT license, so that it's a little bit more friendly for all commercial use. And that's also what has been the basis of the mobile .NET development efforts that Xamarin has undertaken over the last several years. So we have this new member of the family. And of course, between those times, we had introduced the notion of .NET Core. And this is that re-envisioning, reimagining of .NET with the design point of everywhere first, right? So this isn't, we don't think of this as the Windows framework ported to Linux and Mac. This is a framework and runtime designed for Linux, Mac, and Windows. Then we look at, okay, how can we be compatible? Where does it make sense to stay as compatible as possible, not just change things for the sake of changing things? Another part where you may have seen different parts of the team get a little bit more energetic and excited about changing things because they thought they could, but that's an area we'll go back to. So that's kind of the way we think about it. These all have different kind of deployment models. So .NET Framework, Windows component, distributed with Windows. We've made a few attempts over the years to try to distribute it outside of Windows. Those of you that have been doing .NET development for a while and lived in those times know that that didn't work out great. It's a lot better just as a Windows component, so that's what it's going to be. Don't be confused. The .NET Framework will continue to live on, continues to get invested in, we continue to innovate there. Some of the largest pieces of software in the world, some of the largest web properties, largest web services in the world, are developed on the .NET framework, many of them by Microsoft. They're not moving anytime soon. I have seen nothing, I've seen no work items, nothing even on the backlog to take Visual Studio and move it to .NET Core, right? The core of Azure, which is written on the .NET framework, is not moving to .NET Core anytime soon. Team Foundation Server, a big .NET framework application, is not cutting over to .NET Core anytime soon. What they are all doing is looking at where .NET Core represents a technology to address a future need that they have. Team Foundation Server being a great example. They needed to introduce the ability to compile or run builds on non-Windows operating systems. So they needed to create new build agents. .NET Core runs in all the environments they need to run to, so they're using .NET Core to create those build agents and extend the capabilities of the core product into these new spaces, taking advantage of that technology. So that's a lot of how it how we think about it. Does that make sense? Now, when you go one level deeper and get beyond just sort of the architecture view into a little bit deeper architecture, but you realize that that story sounds good, but we have three different class libraries. We have a bunch of different app models. And then we do actually have some common infrastructure underneath. The common infrastructure, awesome. The compilers, the runtime components, the languages themselves, those are actually shared or well on the path of being shared across all those members of the .NET family today. Definitely the left two, the Xamarin one is actually really close to picking up all of that as well. And those are on the backlog. I have seen tasks to do that work. But the class libraries, they're not as consistent as we'd like them to be. So we invented PCLs, or portable class libraries, as a way to write code that would run across all of them. How many folks have written PCLs? How many of you enjoyed it? It actually wasn't too bad to begin with. It was pretty straightforward. The challenge became that when you implement a PCL or when you design a PCL, the first thing that happens is you get a series of checkboxes where you tell us what versions of .NET did you want to target. And you build against that. And if we introduce a new version of .NET, your component's probably not going to run against it because they didn't know about it and couldn't declare it, or couldn't declare support for it. So you'd have to go back and rebuild and rebuild and rebuild. You also had this weird, crazy intersection of things where essentially we would basically compute the intersection point and you would get the least common denominator across all those platforms. So if you wanted to talk to the file system using .NET and also target the UWP app model on .NET Core, sorry, probably not gonna be able to do that because it didn't exist there, so we weren't gonna let you do it on .NET Framework either or in Xamarin either when they had it. So that's a problem, and that's something that we've been looking at a lot and thinking about. And to address that, we're introducing the notion of the .NET Standard Library. So this will be one consistent library surface area that exists across all of those app models and all those framework families. So you truly will be able to have one library that you can target and work across them all. As far as what that means for us and for the rest of the ecosystem to innovate, well, the majority will think about our innovation now at these different layers. We'll innovate in the common area, which we always share across everything. We'll innovate in the standard library area so that as it gets revved, it exists across all those different members of the framework family, all those different app models. We'll innovate in the app model layer as well, so if there's things specific to the web stack, we will innovate in the web stack. And of course, we'll innovate in the tools, which you can probably not read at all, across the family of tools that are the kind of the Visual Studio family. So Visual Studio itself, the IDE that runs on Windows, Visual Studio Code, our cross-platform kind of core developer experience. And actually, I should put Xamarin Studio in here as well. It's another kind of member of that family that sort of sits in between, I'd say, Visual Studio on Windows and Visual Studio Code cross-platform. It's more of a cross-platform IDE kind of experience. So that's kind of the way we think about this. This is what we're working towards. .NET Standard Library isn't there today. You'll start seeing it appear over the next several months as we continue to evolve .NET Core. we had to make a fundamental shift in the way the framework team thought about things, which was the framework team used to go with a design point that was if you saw the API, you could call the API and you could use the API. With the .NET Standard Library, you're going to find APIs that just don't make sense in some of these, you know, families of the framework or some of these app models. The API may still be there, and if you call it and execute it on, I don't know, the new Microsoft necklace or whatever comes out next, but it didn't make any sense, then it'll throw a platform, you know, not implemented or not supported kind of exception. The thought process being, it probably shouldn't, you probably weren't gonna try to call it anyway on that platform, right? You're probably looking at a smaller scope, but not to avoid this minimum common denominator thing, we wanted to go for the largest common denominator approach instead. So that's the way we're thinking about it. Again, this will all be done kind of in collaboration with the ecosystem, with you, with any and all that choose to participate. So it'll all happen on GitHub. I encourage you to jump in and participate there as well. So that's kind of how we think about the framework and the families or versions of the framework that are out there. I've seen some heads nodding, so I hope that makes sense. That either means you're really coming off the sugar thing and you're just trying to stay awake. Nice thing about that move, at least it looks like you're agreeing with me. But that's how we think about it. What that means then is for the, well, we think about .NET Core, and that's kind of what we'll talk about most of the rest of this afternoon, is that it's really targeted at a couple specific workloads today. It's targeted at the Universal Windows platform. It is the framework version that you run and build against when you're building UWP apps. It's also what .NET Core is targeting. So it's targeted at that server kind of workload. The third one that we don't talk about as much, and we don't tend to show in these slides, because it's often more of a developer-oriented thing a lot of times, is utilities or core libraries and drivers and things like that, where you need the ability to write a piece of functionality and have it available on all the places that we're interacting with developers or all the places your clients and customers are asking to deploy their applications. Some examples of things that fall in that category. Visual Studio Code, its debugger. Its debugger interface is written in managed code against .NET Core. And Visual Studio Code needs to run across Windows, Mac, and Linux, right? We had a bunch of code that was really interesting to reuse that was already written in managed code. The SQL Server team, I can now talk about this, because now that they've announced it, you know, everybody's aware that the next version of SQL Server, you know, is intended to run on Linux. Well, there's a ton of developer-oriented infrastructure, management infrastructure for SQL Server that's all written in C#. They don't want to rewrite that, but they need to execute it locally in Linux environments or in Mac environments in some cases. So getting that moved into and targeting .NET Core provides the fastest path for them to be able to do that. Some of the SDKs we write for Azure and those services, also same thing. They're .NET Core-based things because we had a wealth of managed code already developed to access those. Rather than scrapping it, starting all over again, we wanted to leverage a lot of those assets, bring them over, and make them available everywhere they needed to run. Does that make any sense? And so with that, what I want to do is I want to introduce Eric from CData, one of our kind of customers or partners, and let him talk a little bit about how they're taking advantage of .NET Core for some of their products. So Eric, if you want to come on up, and if we can switch to machine number 2 in the back. Look at that.
Does that work?
It's like we knew what we were doing.
Does the mic work?
Did you get it turned on?
I did. It's on?
Cool.
You hear it now? Okay. All right. Thank you, Jay. I appreciate the opportunity to come here and kind of show how we're leveraging .NET Core to enable our ODBC drivers to work on Linux, Unix, and Mac. Again, my name is Eric Madriaga. I'm the Director of Marketing for CData. And today I kind of want to show a few demos of using our drivers on Linux. Before I do that, I'd like to talk a little bit about our company and what we provide and to see why we are investing in .NET Core moving forward. So what we do at CData is we build drivers, like I mentioned, ODBC drivers, ADO.NET data providers, JDBC drivers, BizTalk adapters, SQL Server Integration Services, components that provide a standards-based interface for communicating with all different types of data. I want to say all types of data, not just databases, but web APIs and other applications, things like CRM systems, ERP systems, those kind of sources. They provide real-time access, so they're full read, write, update, delete capable. And this is kind of an overview of our technology stack and how we fit, right? So by using standard drivers, current tooling that exists, BI tools, ETL tools, even software applications can all access those sources through standard interfaces. They go through our drivers and then connect to whatever backend systems that we provide access to. So one of our big tenets is that we provide software and not services. We don't build a cloud infrastructure that you're connecting through. These are direct data sources that you embed either in your applications or on your system. And we don't get in the way of that data communication at all. And to give you an idea of some of the data sources that we provide access to, everything from big data sources and NoSQL to CRM systems like Salesforce and Dynamics, even Excel spreadsheets. You can use an ODBC driver, install it on your system, and pull data out of Salesforce using Transact SQL to communicate, pull in your leads, do updates, deletes, all that, those kind of capabilities. So why did we invest in Core CLR? So business need was definitely paramount when looking at bringing our technologies to natively as ODBC to Linux, Unix, and Mac. We have a number of BI and ETL tool vendors that OEM our products that support ODBC and want to have the connectivity with those other data sources in their applications. So that's kind of the business driver behind it. Internally, we build everything from kind of a C# base. The C# framework that we've developed internally spits out native form factors for ODBC, for BizTalk, for SSIS. Even our native pure Java JDBC drivers are all derived from this common C# code base, right? So we use that to leverage and develop and use our core CLR, I'm sorry, to we use that in order to reuse that code base for core CLR, right? We use the core CLR technology with our C# framework to auto-generate our ODBC drivers for Linux and Mac. And the things that are important to us is the ability that it's cross-platform, that it's open, and the speed is also critical, right? So people can evaluate a driver's speed very easily, embedding them into their applications. So the fact that Core CLR was very lightweight and fast made a big difference and really was one of the drivers behind us investing in that technology. So I can show a couple of demos here. Two sets. I have one using Core CLR and our ODBC drivers for MySQL. Mac here. Give me one second here. Let me run. I have an instance of Ubuntu running on virtual machine. All right. Let's hope that pulls up. Switch. Okay, one second. Does that come up?
Yep.
Okay, great. Okay, so the first thing we'll look at is we have a couple of PHP demos. I have Apache installed on our system. And in public HTML here, we have a couple of PHP demos, right? So this is the standard MySQL demo. We have a MySQL driver for connecting because of speed and performance. We've built that demo out. So I'll show you kind of the code here. This is, you know, kind of standard PHP code, right? Set your connection string, use our MySQL driver. This is the MySQL server instance running here. So I can go MySQL. Okay. Use world. Okay. Okay, so this is just a MySQL database that includes a bunch of cities, countries, and languages and things there. And that's what this is selecting from. It's doing a select star from city, right? And we've got Apache running here. And this is calling the MySQL demo here. Using our ODBC driver, it's just connecting to MySQL, running a select star from city, iterating over those fields, and outputting everything. Right, so this is pretty standard stuff. More interesting is doing the exact same thing on Salesforce. So here we have another PHP demo. So here we're using our test account. We have an auth token to connect, and then we're selecting a subset of data, name, billing street, phone, website information from our Salesforce account, right? And again, this is being called from PHP using our ODBC driver that was all built with CoreCLR. And so we call that there. And you can see here, give a second, the network here is a little slow. Second, there we go. So that's it. That's using our ODBC driver to select and pull down data using PHP, using our ODBC driver there. One of the other benefits to using CoreCLR is that we have ADO.NET as well on ASP.NET 5. So if you look at, we have another version here. I'll show the MySQL demo. So this runs ASP.NET 5 on Linux, starts the server. Second here. ASP.NET. Case sensitivity. Okay, so that's going to start the server on port 5000. And that is this demo here. One second here. Demos, MySQL ASP, and this was built with Razor syntax, so we have the views, and you can see using our ASP.NET, ADO.NET data provider, you know, how you'd communicate with that. And so I have it running on port 5000. So there you go. And again, I can do the exact same thing with our Salesforce demo using ASP.NET as well. This is just starting the server for the Salesforce demo.
We should pull that information back up. And I think that one does a select star, and so it gets a little more data back in that pull.
Gotta love hotel networks.
Sorry for that. There we go.
Cool.
So again, this is pulling all of the data back from that table in Salesforce. And a bunch of test account data in here as well.
So that's it. That's our drivers working on Linux. Again, you know, the customer demand for us was driven by our BI and ETL tool vendors, as well as other customers that were interested in doing things like accessing this kind of data from Excel on the Mac, for example. They want to be able to take Excel on the Mac and do that kind of communication with these different data sources.
Oops. And so from a performance perspective, as I said, performance was very important for us. You can see here that the performance was excellent. It's equivalent to our ODBC driver performance on Windows. And it's about twice as fast as the native open source MySQL driver for connecting to MySQL Server. Right, so that was great for us.
Cool.
And that's it, really. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time. I appreciate the ability to kind of show what we're doing with CoreCLR. And if you have any questions or anything, we have a booth outside. We'll be there for another 15 or 20 minutes kind of after the show if you want to come by and talk to us. Okay?
Cool.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. We can switch back to machine one. One of the things that was really exciting for me as the team authoring the technology they were building on was when I got the mail from them, then they mentioned, hey, we're seeing 2x performance improvements over our existing native stuff. And I'm like, whoa, we hadn't even started performance tuning yet. So that was a positive thing. And I'll talk a little bit more about some of the performance we're seeing for out of .NET Core on the Linux and Mac versus Windows platforms. To steal my own thunder, and amongst friends here, we've got the Windows Server team doing some work now because we're faster on Linux than we are on Windows right now. So often I get asked the other question, which is, oh, is it going to perform well? Well, it turns out yes, a little bit better. So with that, what I thought we'd do is let's go spend the rest of the time doing some other demos. Just the other reason I wanted to show you that demo was I think it helps drive home the fact that, it's a little bit non-traditional from what you think of as a demo of what we would show at a developer or in a conference, right? We weren't necessarily building, just an ASP.NET app running it on Linux, just showing how we can build these components and libraries and utilities that have demands to run in multiple places, but build them off of a single code base and single set of technology. So, of course, for development, we can do whatever we want is really the way to think about it. So if you're on Windows, use Visual Studio, the tool you know and love. It will be awesome. If you're on a Mac, you can use Visual Studio Code. You can use Xamarin Studio. You can use Project Writer from JetBrains when it comes out. You can use Sublime. You can use whatever editor you want to be able to author these things. Same thing in a Linux environment. That was one of the design points we took as well, one of the reasons you see some of the things change in just the overall project structure of .NET Core-based applications. We wanted them to be more friendly to just straight text editing tools, command line tools, those kinds of things. If you've tried to do ASP.NET development on the .NET framework outside of Visual Studio, you are a brave, brave person, because there's a lot of magic that Visual Studio does for you in XML files and build tasks and all those kind of crazy things that we just wanted to really remove all of that and let Visual Studio and those tools do the magic by automating tasks for you, but not, you know, preventing you from getting in and just getting your hands dirty and going for it. So what I thought we'd do is let's start with kind of the Visual Studio experience. So inside of Visual Studio, right, we can go in, we can create our project. I'll try to go through this fairly quickly because I'm sure you've probably seen it a number of times. The key here is that, you know, because what we're creating, and I'll talk more about this in a minute, but because we're creating is at the library layer most often when you're developing your applications, you can develop on any platform and deploy to the other platform. You're writing code that is then going to get translated for you right into machine code, into bytecode, on the platform it's deployed to later. So as long as you're programming to the frameworks, you can build on Windows, deploy on Linux, deploy to a Mac. You can build on a Mac, deploy to Windows, and it's all going to just work for you. That's part of the design point we have. The key things, if you have not seen this or spent time with it, one of the big philosophy changes, oops, don't want to go there, even though it works, is switching from the notion of assembly references to package references, really making package management a first-class thing. So you think about the capabilities, let the package manager figure out how to sort out whatever dependencies you have between packages and so forth. You don't have to get into that on your own. The other thing that we do, and I think this is probably the easiest way to show it, is we take advantage of some of the new compiler technology. So in this case, we're going to use Roslyn, and the host for ASP.NET, in this case, Kestrel, is going to use Roslyn to compile the C# code that's part of our application. And it's going to do it in memory. So if I go look at my About page, I see this. If I go back to Visual Studio and kind of go into the code a little bit here, and we just go into the controllers. In the home controller, we can see that we have some C# code here that's, you know, putting that message out, right? Your application description. This is code, right? So we'll just change that code, simply save it, switch back over, and I can refresh, I can navigate around, but essentially causing a navigation to happen is going to cause the Kestrel engine to realize that that code file was changed, recompile the code in memory, and put it back out there for you. Just creating, in one sense, a better iterative loop for you. You don't have to stop and start and stop and start all the time. But as we'll see, it also makes it easier to just use any old text editor on any platform because that compilation will happen, the build step will happen for you. Of course, this is the default and optimization for development time. When you go deploy to production, you can still compile. Most people don't want to put source code out on their production servers. I understand that. So you can still go through your normal build chain, but this just sort of as a development time experience. The other thing I want to show you was, so now that I've done this, let's say I want to go and deploy this maybe to a Linux environment. And so what we've done is we've added the ability we can go and add support for deploying these things to other environments. So in this case, we could add Docker support. Now what this is going to do is it's going to go out and it's going to scaffold out a lot of stuff for us to do Docker development. Now this is the most recent version of the Visual Studio Docker tooling. You may have seen this before where we use it as a publish target. We sort of pushed into a container somewhere. This is now more optimized for the way people actually use Docker. So it's set up to do Docker on F5. So I can F5 container spun up. As I'm making changes, we're just pushing it into the container for you and iteratively working on things like that and running in whatever host environment you want that container to be in. In this case, you know, it could be a Ubuntu image running and so forth. So if we F5 this, create the packet, create the image, spin it up, attach the debugger to it, and just kind of go iterating. Now, of course, that can't work for me today because I broke it. I apologize. I frantically worked for the last 2 hours to try to fix it, but I couldn't. But trust me, it works. You can do it. So that's a little bit of kind of the Visual Studio kind of experience. So thinking about, the way I think about that is as an existing .NET developer using Visual Studio, using ASP.NET, we're just extending your reach, right? We're now allowing you to take those skills, take that knowledge, and target new places. You can deploy to Linux. You can, you know, target new environments like that from that same familiar and kind of known experience. If we switch over to machine 3, let's take a look at a different version of that experience. So this is, so I'm sitting on my Mac that actually has a Microsoft asset tag on it. which I never would have thought was possible when I joined the company a long time ago. But I've gone and I've already installed ASP.NET Core and .NET Core. Now, I'm still running the RC version, the publicly available version from November, just so that you could do the same things that I'm going to do. Now, in this case, I'm just do this straight from the command line. So as a command line developer, I want to be in control. I want to issue and tell the system, tell the environment what I want it to do. But I'm still going to probably use a scaffolding tool. So I can do, you know, Yo ASP.NET, I'll use Yeoman. And I'll use the scaffolding tool to create the basics of an application. In this case, we'll create a basic web application . Call it web demo basic. We'll move to that directory. And now you see that what Yeoman has also told me as part of this is, hey, you're not done. You got some more work you need to do, right? We scaffolded out all the code, and if we went to look at it, we'd see that it looks pretty much like what that project looked like when I used Visual Studio. This one's got a few less things because I did no authentication. Visual Studio did authentication by default, so that's where a few of the extra files showed up. But otherwise, it's the same thing. Going forward, they will be the same thing. Visual Studio will drive the same scaffolding tools on your behalf, so we're consistent, regardless of where you started. But now that I've got it, I need to actually go and do a restore. So I need to restore those packages. You didn't see me do that in Visual Studio. If you were paying attention, you saw Visual Studio doing it on my behalf, right? So that's kind of where this idea of Visual Studio just automating some tasks for you. But in our case, we're doing it ourselves because we're on the command line. And I'll just start this up. DNX Web, that'll launch that Kestrel cross-platform host that you saw Eric using as well. And then we'll just go into our browser. Not really, we'll go into our browser. Localhost. 5000. And boom, there's ASP.NET Core compiling and running on a Mac. Pretty cool, right? Now I messed up, but okay. Pretend I didn't control break that. Pretend I didn't. I was smart enough to not do that, but I did it anyway. So I'm gonna go into Visual Studio Code. So this is Visual Studio Code. Let's open that up, let's make it a little bigger. So this, you know, think of this as a developer-centric, developer-oriented editing experience. It's not an IDE. It's a developer-oriented tool, right? It knows how to write code. It knows how to, you know, debug. It knows how to do those kinds of things. But we can come in here, and we can use this editor and, you know, make similar kinds of changes. Just so you see what I'm doing, we'll go in here. We'll just kind of save it, flip back over. Now, had I not stopped this, we wouldn't have had to do this. We could have left it running, and you would have seen me just go refresh in the browser, and the same thing would have happened, right? So in this case, I did relaunch it, but if I go back over here and go to About, you'll see that the compiler has again picked up the change, has compiled it, and issued the same response. I didn't have to mess around with build tasks in MS Build and all those kinds of things. Cool? So that's the basic concepts behind this, just a consistency across these things, being able to create the different kinds of projects, consistency across everything, no matter what tool you used. You're still kind of working together. If I go back and look inside of VS Code, a couple things, you know, if you're not familiar with this, you know, we get, you know, statement completion, we get IntelliSense, we get navigation. We now have debugging as well available as an extension, so you can actually hit breakpoints and so forth and do variable inspection and so forth for C# code within Visual Studio Code on a Mac or Linux or Windows. A couple of things I'll just show you. I mentioned the move to package-based references versus assemblies. So that's what this is showing. This is the project.json file that describes what components I'm using. It's just a JSON file. It's just a text file. It's much easier to go and author and manage without a tool like Visual Studio with just a text editor. And then, of course, it's an artifact, so it gets checked in and moved around. It's probably one of the things I should have mentioned. Actually, let's do that. Let's go over here. So we've extended the concept of the scaffolding as well. So we have a Docker template for Yeoman as well. right? So if I want to go now do the same thing I did in Visual Studio where I started and I built it, now I want to go kind of Dockerize it, containerize it, I can go in and use a scaffolding tool for that. I just come in and say, yep, I'm using ASP.NET 5, using RC1, listing at 5,000. Because I'm sitting in the directory where the code is, it's realized, okay, this is what you want to use. And it's now gone and created and scaffolded out a bunch of stuff for me. We can look at it here. Visual Studio Code will pick up this stuff as well, and we see we've now added a bunch of Docker-specific artifacts to your project. This is the same thing Visual Studio would do, had done. It just added a bunch of artifacts to our project. The way to think about this is, over the years, Visual Studio has gotten really good at creating wizards and UI to help you configure your development machine. New person comes to the team, they're really hoping you took good notes, right? Because they got to go through those same wizards and enter that same information that you did. Now what we're doing is actually using these consistent artifacts, the same ones that the tools themselves use. The wizards and things are still there. They're just authoring these artifacts. They're putting these things in these files. They can now be checked in. New person comes to the team. They enlist, sync, boom. They're up and running because they've got the same artifacts. You change it. You don't like our Docker file. You need to add new things to it. You need to extend it. Fine. Go nuts. That's the file that will get executed when the tools run. We don't override it. We don't change anything. Unless you come back in and ask us to go do it through the UI. So this is just sort of getting ourselves smarter, getting ourselves more aware of, you know, the cross-platform nature of things, getting more aware of multiple tools, working better in those kinds of environments. So that's something that you'll see across a lot of the work we do. So that all kind of makes sense. Let's switch back to machine number one. Showed you most of that stuff. Talked about what this is. Key here, think of it as just this lightweight cross-platform editor that understands developers. It understands code. The language services that plug into VS Code and plug into Visual Studio, they're consistent. So as we extend the capabilities of, you know, the developer experience for refactorings and navigation and code styling and those kind of things, we're trying to do it in a way that can be picked up automatically or with very little work by these other tools, so it's consistent across the experiences. If you invest in code style rules for your development team in Visual Studio, and you have a few folks running Visual Studio Code on the Mac, we want to make sure they have the same tools to help them, so their code stays just as consistent and works the same way. Accessing data, you saw a little bit of it, but this is an area of investment that we've made quite a bit of progress on. It kind of falls in three buckets. There's the SQL Server stuff, which will be available kind of more completely as part of the next release candidate for .NET Core coming out, to target SQL Server on-premise or Azure SQL databases. It's the exact same API. You would not have to change code, your data access code to make that work. We have a number of open source providers, you know, MySQL, PostgreSQL, MongoDB, Cassandra, the list is actually longer than that, that are also being actively developed. So if you're using .NET to talk to one of these kind of data stores today on the .NET framework, those providers are either available or becoming available on .NET Core as well. And then, of course, we have partners that are implementing additional providers. So Oracle is creating their provider and so forth. The key here is that the data access APIs that you're calling and writing code against are the same. There may be a few exceptions where something isn't available yet, or there's a capability of Windows someone was taking advantage of and they haven't kind of figured out how to move it over to a Linux equivalent yet, but those are actually being addressed over the next kind of couple milestones of the products as well. I mentioned that the code you write in .NET and code you write in C# or VB to target .NET Core and run across these platforms is platform independent. You're writing against the .NET APIs. If you need to, or you want to, you can dip down into the native APIs as well, and you have to manage that yourself, kind of do your typical pound defines or whatever you want to do, to whatever technique you want to use. But think of it as you have the ability to p-invoke in Windows, you'll have the same capability in on Linux and the Mac as well if you need to take advantage of it or want to take advantage of it. You shouldn't have to. Turns out that for the framework itself, I want to say that just over 85% of the framework code is common. So the code we wrote for the .NET framework, .NET Core framework, is common across Windows, Mac, and Linux. And then that last 15% is split about, I think it's about 12% is Linux-specific, and then a very small percent is Mac-specific, which you'd expect because they're kind of based off each other. So that's pretty good. That's pretty high reuse. Talking a little bit about deployment, I mentioned that you can use tools like Visual Studio. If you want to do Docker, you can do containerization. You can X-copy these things. You can put them in the clouds. We have, I can't name them by name, but we have a few customers that are deployed in production already with .NET Core running on Linux. A couple of them are running in Amazon. A couple of them are running in Azure. And they're fairly high traffic properties, which made me a little nervous that they were doing it, but so far we've gotten no calls, so that's good. It's there. The changes, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. So lots of options. The idea here is, another kind of theme here is choice. We're giving you choice. We're ensuring that you have the ability to take .NET, build your applications and take them where you need to go, deploy them in the manner you need to work in the way you want to work, and so forth. I mentioned, of course, this is developed in the open. I thought this was an interesting slide to pull in. The numbers are already out of date. It's about the process. The process has been working. The momentum in the ecosystem is pretty strong. We've got a number of people contributing to the repositories. Roughly, as a whole, something in the neighborhood of 15% across the .NET Core code bases, so compiler, runtime, frameworks, and so forth, ASP.NET Web Stack, is coming from non-Microsoft engineers. Now, often when I say that, I tend to get some questions like, what does that mean? Isn't that bad? No, it's really good. The way to think about this is that there is the open source version of .NET Core and the technologies related to it available in GitHub under the MIT license. You take it, you build it. If we put binaries out there, you take them, you deploy them. You're on your own. There is the Microsoft-supported distributions of this stuff that will come out in the normal Microsoft license agreement with full support. And they'll be available on different distributions of Linux, they'll be available for Mac, they'll be available for Windows. You're in exactly the same spot as you were before. All the stuff that we do as we're releasing the product, all the compliance checking, scanning, all that kind of stuff is exactly the same as we used to always do. And it's fully supported. In the case of some of the distributions, we have fairly sophisticated support models. So if you are a Red Hat Enterprise Linux customer and you deploy .NET as part of your Red Hat into your Red Hat environment, you can call Red Hat. They'll support .NET Core. You can call Microsoft, too, and we'll support it as well. So you don't get in this weird, sorry, call them, sorry, call them. Like, we didn't want that, so that we have those great support models in place for both. And then, of course, for distributions that we don't officially support but are available in the ecosystem, then you're just kind of in that community-supported model. So like FreeBSD is one that I know the community has been working on to get supported. That would be a community-supported model if you wanted to deploy to FreeBSD. One of the things that's really cool that's happened is some of the results of the kind of quality and impact that the ecosystem has had, that the developers engaging that aren't part of the Microsoft engineering team have contributed. Talk down here in the bottom about some of the performance statistics, 1.15 million requests per second into ASP.NET Core. That's wrong. It's 1.6 million now, as soon as the pull request goes through. So internally in our labs, it's already that. That's 6x node. I have a lot of fun sometimes where you can go out actually, and we could if, well, we could. The performance lab information is out on GitHub as well. So if you go ASP.NET on GitHub, WAC performance or benchmarks, you'll find the repo information about the performance tests we're running. What the configurations are, what the code is, how to get it set up in your own environment, and so forth. And you can see the progress that we're making, and you see it stack up against the other environments. Often when I ask people, a lot of people think Node's the fastest web stack out there. It's not. It's actually a Java derivative, Java-based stack. But for some of them, we're creeping up really, really quick in the overall stack. An interesting aspect of this is about 40% of the performance gains in the Kestrel engine came from a developer in the community, came from someone that doesn't work for Microsoft. Awesome, cool, kind of cool way that it happened. I think it's cool the way it happened. Basically, someone was making some pull requests into the Kestrel engine that were performance related. The primary architect for that component saw it, just started to contact the person directly, say, hey, what are you working on? You're doing some interesting stuff here. And initially the person said, oh, I'm just kind of playing around. I'm building a service on top of .NET Core and just seeing what kind of performance I could get out of Kestrel or how to play around with that as a code base to then go fork off and do my own thing. And he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Why are you going to fork it? Let's just make this one the good one, right? And so that developer did and kind of was convinced, yeah, you're right. Let's just go work together. We'll have one thing that's awesome rather than two different ones that are both pretty good. And so that's where a lot of those performance gains came from. Let me, just because it's cool, let me show you a video of what that is all about.
Create a game of such massive scale that's never been created before.
We really wanted it to run.
We wanted to create a game of such massive scale that's never been created before.
We really wanted it to run naturally in the browsers. Anyone can play it immediately, whether it's your laptop or your phone or your PC.
We were building a system that could cope with huge demand and huge concurrency, huge availability. Around about the same time Service Fabric came about.
Say two alliances suddenly decide to go to war on a whim. They all meet in space at the same time to duke it out.
Our microservices in Azure Service Fabric will automatically scale up, begin unfolding space, and seamlessly distribute the load across all the nodes in the system.
We've tested it up to 50,000 concurrent players in the same battle arena. We were handling 267 million application messages a second.
Our game microservices are built using ASP.NET Core. It gives us superior performance. ASP.NET Core is open source. That allows us to contribute back to it if we have any performance issues, which then Microsoft review, and together we make a better product. Our contributions to Kestrel have reduced allocations, lowered latencies, and allowed it to be already 2,300% faster than previous incarnations of ASP.NET and more than six times faster than Node.js.
We run public player versus player alpha playtests once a month where anyone can just drop in. All you need is a modern browser that runs WebGL, turn up at the website, and you can play the game against other players around the world.
Cool. And so, in case you didn't pick up on it, Ben is the guy that I was referring to that made all those performance improvements. That company, Age of Ascent, is a grand total of six people. That includes CEOs, marketing, all those kinds of things in that six. So they built that game with a very small number of engineers and also contributed into making kind of .NET Core better for all of us, which is pretty cool. So if you ever see Ben, he's pretty easy to spot. Say hi, give him a pat on the back. He's a pretty cool guy. So where are we? What's next? Well, I mentioned before that we had this roadmap that was public and still is public. It just doesn't have as much useful information in it now as it used to have. So we have an RC release candidate of .NET Core, ASP.NET Core that we put out back in November. That's still the most recent publicly available version. Since then, we have been moving things over to a consistent single tool chain. If you saw Scott earlier, they probably talked about it. They may have even shown the .NET thing. So rather than DNX and DNU and all that stuff, you just now use a .NET CLI to drive all that for yourself. We've also started moving ourselves more into this standard library approach. Those things were a little more work than the team had anticipated, and that's what's pushed this out. So coming soon, I would say within 3 weeks, you'll see a second release candidate that will be on that new kind of infrastructure. Reality is that the changes there end up being almost exclusively in the what we call the tool chain, right? So the DNX, DNU kind of commands are now different, replumbing all the tools to work that way, a few changes to the way packages are defined, but the actual APIs of the framework and the libraries had very few breaking changes to them. There's additive changes, there's new stuff there, but the existing APIs are pretty much there. Most of the folks that have been building on the RC1 that internally that have, well, we've started to move into the early versions of RC2 did not have significant work to do. It was very, very minor. Just a couple hours to fix up a few changes and they were off and running. So if you are looking to get going into .NET Core, ASP.NET Core across platform, start with the RC. It's gonna give you, from a code perspective, a pretty straightforward path. The work continuing between now and the final GA, the normal stuff, reliability, performance, continued performance, some final rounding out of the API surface area and so forth. I expect general availability of this to be sometime in the summer, so think July timeframe, June, July timeframe. All that said, you can deploy into production on the bits that are available today. Customers have. You can deploy in production on the release candidate 2 bits when they become available. They're fully supported. They will be fully supported as well. Or you can deploy on the ones that come in the summer. So all that to say is, if you feel like you've got a need that .NET Core can satisfy and you need to get moving on it and you would have used a different technology, definitely encourage you to consider looking at .NET Core and ASP.NET Core to do that and to do that work. So with that, we've got a few more minutes. We can take a couple questions broadly. We can also just disband and you guys can come up and ask questions individually if you want. And the rest of you can get a head start to the bars or wherever is next for you. But with that, I do hope this was helpful and informative for you and gave you a good context of what it is we're trying to do, why we're doing what we're doing, what our objectives are here with it. And enjoy the rest of your time at Dev Intersection. Thanks a lot.